very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. Ted Proferis from the School of Oriental and African Studies, where he teaches in the Study of Religions department. His interests have been in the Vedic traditions and Vedic interpretation. He's kindly come up to share some of his recent work with us this afternoon. So I'll just hand it over to you. Oh, I didn't read out the title of your talk. Perhaps you would do that.
Well, why don't I introduce it? The topic of my talk today is going to be essentially the poetics of sovereignty within the Vedic liturgical materials. And I'll get started in just a minute, but I'll let you know a couple of the sort of the parameters. Within the context of the talk today, I won't be going into sort of a lot of the substantiation of some of the premises, and we can perhaps discuss that after the talk is over. The questions that will occupy us specifically today are broadly, how is the theme of the negotiation of sovereignty reflected in the early liturgical poetry of the Rig in the Atharva Veda? And what does this reveal about the logic and symbolism of Vedic liturgical discourse? As the theme is far too broad to deal with comprehensively in the time available to us, I'm going to focus specifically on how constructions of sovereignty were articulated through poetic and ritual manipulations of the substance of the elements of fire and water. And even with the treatment of fire and water, ritually and poetically, I can only scratch the surface here today. A few preliminary remarks concerning the basic features of sovereignty and society in the early Vedic period can serve to orient us in our discussion. The settlement pattern of the Vedic groups was characterized by alternating periods of fixed habitation, kshema, and mobilization, or yoga. Under conditions of fixed habitation, the largest cooperative unit of Rig Vedic society was the clan, or viewed topographically the clan settlement, the vish. This terminology, of course, differs somewhat to the use of vish as it's generally translated and understood conceptually within the Varna system, and one should keep that in mind. Each clan had at its head a clan leader, a vishpati, and within the clan, the basic subgrouping was the household consisting of an extended family with the master of the house at its head. As participation in the political life of the clan would have been exclusive to heads of households, a clan leader would have been both clan lord as well as house lord. The forms of social, economic, and political life were fundamentally altered during the contrasting periods of mobilization. As fixed habitation was abandoned under external pressures, the otherwise autonomous clans united with one another under the leadership of a single warlord, king, or chieftain, a raja. Through their headmen, the clans selected the king, and I'll just simply translate Rajan as king, despite the objections that have been raised by some. Through their headmen, the clans selected the king and bestowed sovereignty upon him. In return, they expected to profit from the victory a strong leader would secure. Although the clan leaders had the power to select the king, once the selection had been made, they turned over authority to him for the duration of the crisis or campaign of acquisition. This functional unity of the clans would end, however, as soon as there was no longer a need for collaborative action. This situation reflects what social anthropologists have sometimes called a fission and fusion process, whereby smaller social units within a segmentary kinship system temporarily unite to form a larger and more centralized political organization in order to cope with an external threat. Despite the difficulties in reconstructing a picture of early Vedic society from the sources at our disposal, this model appears to be consistent with the ritual and poetic motifs to which we will now turn. Long ago, Alfred Hillebrandt argued that the Rig Veda knew of a communal fire associated with a particular territory or community. The public character of this fire emerged, he felt, from those passages in which the figure of Agni, particularly Agni Vaishvamana, appears as a tribal god associated with a tribal leader. Vaishvanara's association with particular tribes, such as the Puru and the Parata, and the frequent references to fire's leadership of the clans, led Hillebrandt to the conclusion that the Vaishvanara fire belonged to the house of the king and constituted the direct manifestation of a given polity's might and sovereignty. In her account of, the political dimensions of the figure of Agni Vaishvanara, F.B. Finlay affirmed that the god is a symbol of power identified specifically with the Aryan peoples, and that he is both the center of the Aryan ritual cult as well as the manifestation of the Aryans' victorious might in battle. However, she judged the evidence to be too scanty to prove Hillebrand's thesis that early Vedic polities defined themselves through identification with a communal fire associated with a king or chieftain. In my opinion, Hillebrand's hypothesis accounts exceptionally well not only for the particular passages cited by him, but for the thematics of the fire god as a whole. There is a passage in an Agni hymn of the sixth mandala of the Rig Veda that reads as follows. The Bharata fire has just come, the smasher of defense manifest to many, Devadasa's settlement lord. What is particularly noteworthy about this stanza is that the fire, associated with the Bharata tribe, is presented as the lord of settlements and at the same time linked to the famous Bharata leader Devadasa. If the fire is a representation of Bharata sovereignty possessed by the human chief Devadasa, then it is easy to see why it would acquire the characteristics of a settlement lord properly belonging to Devadasa himself. The king's fire becomes the center of the tribal community and its ritual activity. Thus it is said to be manifest to many. Of what does the larger community consist, and who are the many to which the fire is manifest? In another hymn, the fire of the Bharata is presented as the ritual focus of the Aryan clans. The Aryan clans nourish fire, reads Rig Veda 196.3, as the first executor of sacrifice to whom offerings have been made, the straight-driving son of power, the Bharata. Rig Veda 10.69 presents what is perhaps the clearest example of the association of fire with a tribal king, and of the ritual role of the clans in relation to this fire. The hymn is dedicated in its entirety to extolling the glory and power of the fire belonging to and descended from the Bharata king or leader Bhadriashva. It illustrates better than any other item of evidence the existence of a central fire attended by multiple clans and expressing the sovereignty of the tribe. Bhadriashva is elsewhere presented as the father of the great Bharata leader Devadasa, who, as we have already seen, was himself in possession of the Bharata fire. In the present hymn, the fire is said to belong to Vadriyashva. It was Vadriyashva who kindled this fire, and he is said to have carried the fire like a father carries a son. The patronymic Vadriyashva is used of the fire itself. The third stanza reveals this fire to have been linked with domestic themes, as it is called upon to be protector of the worshippers' households. We imagine, perhaps, the tribal king envisioned as the tribal kingdom envisioned as a single domestic unit, with the king at its head. The fire of Vadriyashva is linked directly to the symbolism of hegemony when it is said to expand widely. It is this fire who is credited with having defeated enemies, both within and outside of the Aryan fold, and with having conquered the resources of the earth, and who is presented as the defender of the worshipper's own group against enemy assaults. The fire is depicted as the one to whom the human clans turn for counsel in war. It is the fire itself that makes strong the fighting men belonging to the clans. The fire is the leader of the warriors who, together with them, burns the battlefield and defeats the enemies. While the martial aspects of Vadriyashva's fire are evident, it is also clear that the fire stands at the center of a ritual proceeding. The kindling of the fire is a theme running throughout the hymn. An oblation of ghee is presented as an act of feeding the fire, thus making him stronger. The men who are kindling the fire bear sacrificial gifts, dakshina, and possess pressed soma juice. Whereas Vadriyashva was the first to kindle this fire, its present incarnation, the actual fire on the ritual ground in front of the composer of this hymn, is produced by the clans who are good allies, Sumitra Vishaha. Geldner prefers to read Sumitra as the name of a royal lineage to which Vadriyashva belongs, but this is highly doubtful. Elsewhere in the Rig Veda, the term appears as an epithet of Soma, as in, be a good ally to us, Soma. In a popular Yajurveda mantra, it is the waters and the plants which are called upon to be good allies. Interpreting Sumitra as good ally is consistent with what we would expect regarding the relationship of the king and the clans on the one hand, and between the various clans on the other. The clans who together kindle the tribal fire of Adiryashva are said to be good allies precisely because the collaborative act of producing the fire is the quintessential expression of their mutually agreed alliances by which they have consolidated under a single sovereign authority. The ritual role of fire in the formation of alliances, mitra, of various kinds is well known, and this has led on occasion to the outright identification of the god of fire, Agni, with the god of alliance, mitra. Thus it is not at all surprising that when the clans together kindle the fire and make offerings of ghee into it, this is construed as an act of alliance formation on the basis of which the participating clans are called good allies. In fact, the formation of alliance through an oblation made into the fire is well attested. For example, Rigveda 359.5, pour in the fire this enjoyable oblation for this praiseworthy alliance, or alternatively, for this god alliance, or contract, as Tima would have had it. In short, the hymn for Vadrashra's fire reflects a ritual that has as its purpose the negotiation of sovereignty. Different clans affirm their unity with each other by kindling a central fire belonging to the head of the royal lineage, whose authority is recognized by all clans. Judging from the martial elements within the hymn, the circumstance giving rise to this affirmation of unity involves the threat of military engagement with an enemy. Now, only free men, householders, possess their own fire. The fire is an emblem of their status, but also of their share of power in the society to which they belong. This is so even in the middle and late Vedic period, as we know. Thus, it is not surprising that sovereignty can be ritually constructed through the manipulations of fire. The smallest social unit endowed with a fire of its own was the household. The individual households of the Vedic communities are the loci for the dispensation of fire. Within the house, the fire is kindled. The fire god's common epithet, Lord of the House, acknowledges the central place of fire in every household, and at the same time signifies the identification of the fire with the householder himself. Fire is also represented as dispersed throughout the clans. He is kindled among human clans, and his presence in all clan settlements means that he is easily summoned for assistance. Just as fire bears the epithet Lord of the House due to his appearance in the home hearths, so does he bear the epithet Clan Lord due to his instantiation of clan identity. The third tier of the hierarchy of fires is that of peoples, the Jana Charshani or Krishti, as the Rigveda text has it, which we can loosely refer to here as the tribe. Fire is the king of the peoples, supreme ruler of the peoples, as well as the upholder of the peoples. It is among all peoples that fire is a guest in every domicile and an inhabitant of each clan settlement. Similarly, the fire is called the king of the clans. In accordance with the fact that fire can represent the lord of the house, the clan lord, as well as the tribal king who exerts control over these lesser entities, one must imagine a network of fires spreading horizontally across the landscape, organized hierarchically in accordance with the relative magnitude of the social grouping with which each was associated. Evidence for the contrast of these various levels of fire is not wanting. The three concentric spheres of the fire's functionality, household, clan, and tribe, are concisely enumerated in a number of passages designed to emphasize the immediate presence of fire at all main levels of the social hierarchy. No level is without fire, nor is any individual unit within each level. Thus, the integration of the horizontal and the vertical, or the hierarchical, distribution of fire could articulate the totality of a Vedic polity, rendering fire an attractive symbol to express a ruler's sovereign power. Control of fire meant control over all levels of society. The effectiveness of fire as a symbol of social and political unity is due not only to its power to express the integration of the organizational units of society. Fire is also intimately linked with lineage, and as such, is a potent symbol of kinship identity. For example, Rigveda 4.7 concerns a fire originally kindled by the Burgus, legendary ancestors of generations long past, who established it in its central place of worship. This very fire, it is said, now extends throughout every clan, distributed among them by the descendants of the legendary Ayu. And it is this fire whose manifestation is accomplished through the act of kindling on the ritual ground. This fire is likewise found in every household, where it is again the focus of sacrificial rites. The implication is obvious. The distribution of an ancestral fire throughout all households and all communities is a vibrant symbol of their shared identity and of their mutual bonds. In the first three stanzas of this hymn, there is an implicit tension between the idea of a single fire kindled once in the remote past and the dissemination of fire, which may be kindled anew at each rite. The fourth verse makes this tension explicit. The fire that is distributed throughout each clan derives from a single source, the wide shining sun, here referred to as Vivasvant. This fire is responsible for the collective domination of the peoples, but is also viewed as residing within the many individual clans that compose them. Here, domination is not presented as an imposition of an alien force, but rather as a factor of an identity shared by distinct communities. It is as a principle of identity that this fire is said to be a symbol, or a ketu, disseminated throughout the clans. The term ketu, which means that through which something else is made outwardly manifest, particularly aspects of light, the term ketu is here applied to the manifestation of clan identity in the form of fire. The ultimate derivation of all fires from Vivasvat, the sun, parallels the well-known fact that the human race, or at least the Aryans, finds its origin in the sun. The fire distributed throughout all levels of all communities can thus be conceived as the hypostasis of the kinship of all members. Through the dispensation of fire, each free member of Vedic society is ultimately bound both to his source in the sun as well as to all the others who affirm their collective identity through fire. In a clan-based society, this means that fire is the sine qua non of the social fabric. As such, it is deployed both as a symbol of affiliation as well as a symbol of hierarchy, as we saw in the case of Vajrayashva's fire. The full exploitation of fire as a symbol of sovereignty was based upon the fire's capacity to express the concept of unity within diversity. In a clan-based society where the proclamation of an overlord's rule depended to a great extent upon the will of separate clans, such a symbol helped regulate the balance between royal authority and clan autonomy. How precisely was this capacity expressed? For the Vedic liturgists, fire, like the sun with which it is identified, may be present in many locations simultaneously, but its nature remains always undivided. Rigveda 8:58:2, only one, fire is kindled in many places. One, the sun penetrates all. The relationship between this single fire and the various instantiations it assumes when kindled in different places by different peoples is elsewhere given expression in the image of a tree and its branches. The other fires are merely your branches, fire. All immortals energize themselves in you. Vaishvanara, you are the navel of the settlements. You hold the peoples like a propping pillar. Like the single tree from which the many branches grow, there is but one fire from which all other fires are derived. This image articulates the symbolic and practical role of fire in binding together disparate groups under a centralizing authority. The fires burning in the many hearths, tended by separate households and settlements, were taken from a central source. While each fire constituted the heart of the social unit to which it belonged, it served at the same time to bind that unit with the others who shared the fire. In this way, fire was the ultimate symbol of social unity, binding a multitude of small groups into a larger polity. Since all fires were derived from the same source, the essence of each was the same. On one level, this essence was interpreted as the deity Agni himself, whose unique capacity it was to manifest simultaneously in myriad locations. On another level, however, the unity of fire was an expression of the political unity of diverse clans bound by allegiance to a common leader and subordinating their individual fires to his own. As the above standard states, Agni Vaishvanara, the fire with power over all men, stands at the center of each and every settlement. This is not to be understood distributively as a reference to the individual hearths spread throughout the settlements, but rather collectively as a reference to the single notional center around which all settlements are organized. That the navel referred to represents the political access of a plurality of communities is made clear through the metaphor that closes the stanza. Just as the central pillar supports whatever is constructed around it, holding firm the various parts of a building in a single structure, so does the fire hold the peoples together, checking their centrifugal tendencies. The image is an architectural variant of the initial depiction of the tree upon which all branches are dependent. It emphasizes the point that social and political cohesion was achieved through the treatment of fire. The subordination of many scattered fires to a central fire recurs in a passage explicitly identifying the central fire with the sovereignty of the Puru. As in the previous example, the image of a tree and its branches is deployed to express the idea of the proliferation of fires from a central source. The application of the epithet Sahasramushka, or 1,000 testicled, further highlights the capacity of the single fire for prolific self-propagation. We Sobaris have come for aid to the 1,000 testicled, fully dominating and all-ruling fire of Trasadasyu, you upon whom the other fires are dependent like branches upon a tree. I join myself with the glory of the peoples, increasing your sovereign powers. Linked as it is to the legendary leader Trasadasyu, there is no doubt that the fire in question here represents the apotheosis of Puru power. It is domination and extensive rule incarnate. That's Avishtian Samraj incarnate. Yet its sovereign powers, or kshatrani, are not quantitatively absolute, for they are made to increase through the glory of the assorted peoples subject to it. The early Vedic concept of glory, dyumna, like the concept of splendor, varchas, which if we have time we can discuss below, is based upon the metaphor of light. The many fires may be derived from the sovereign's fire, but the sovereign's fire burns brighter when the many smaller ones are added to it. Thus it is justifiable to see in this passage a reference to the reciprocity of power relations between a central authority and the smaller social groupings bearing allegiance to it. The dispersal and subsequent reintegration of fire were core elements of the political unity by means of which these power relations are defined. The above passage is not the only one to allude to the production of a single fire from multiple sources. Rigveda 136:1-2 depicts a situation in which the liturgists, working on behalf of their patrons, worship a fire held in common by many clans and established by many peoples. With well-uttered speeches, we appeal on your behalf to the young fire of the many God-serving clans, precisely the one whom the others reverence. The peoples have installed the fire as an increaser of might with oblations. We would worship you. The installation of this fire is executed by a plurality of peoples. It belongs not to a single group, but to the many God-serving clans. The poet's own group is not the only one worshiping the fire, but merely one among a number of others. Significantly, this fire is called might increasing, and the word order and the syntax suggests that it is precisely because it performs this function that the peoples establish it. One may thus plausibly infer that the fire here portrayed symbolizes the fusion of disparate clans with the goal of increasing the strength of the overall polity. The manipulation of fire to express political unity can be seen equally well in a passage contrasting a single fire to a plurality of other fires by which it is accompanied. Fire, come with fires, we select you as Hotar. May the oblation-filled ladle held out anoint you, most worthy of sacrifice, so that you take your seat upon the strewn grass. What is of particular interest about this stanza is that there is a good reason to understand it as superimposing the rite of royal unction onto the rite of establishing the oblation fire. The most archaic form of the ritual for anointing a king involved the unction itself, in which a mixture of various kinds of liquids are poured over the king's body, coupled with the enthronement in which the king mounts the throne and takes his seat. As I mentioned, the clans play an important role in the selection of the king, but they are also prominently represented in the ritual actions that accomplish the unction. Thus, it is reasonable to understand this passage as referring to a rite in which the central tribal fire, representing the tribal leader, is being lit with the fires of the many clans in preparation for the communal ritual in which it will serve as the oblation fire. The ghee poured into the fire to make it flame up is likened to the unction waters, and the strewn grass upon which the fire is established represents the throne. I'll be discussing elsewhere the fact that there's quite a bit of evidence to connect the ritual action of the consecration of the king with the treatment of fire as the king's fire and other aspects and dimensions of the Vedic ritual system. Essentially, what I'm arguing here thus far is simply that fire, both poetically and ritually, is an instrument for defining the interrelationship between the clans who together constituted the sovereign authority of Vedic society, and that the manipulations of these fires articulated these power relationships. It's not only the fire, however, that has this capacity, both ritually and poetically. Water is also used in a similar way. Now, the associations between sovereignty and the waters is well attested in the divine dominion. The gods Soma, Fire, Varuna, and Indra, gods who are within the context of the early Vedic liturgies associated most commonly with kingship, are also those gods associated most commonly with water. In addition, it's well attested that water is closely connected to the human sovereign. I'll skip over some evidence for this, but this was shown long ago by Schlerat, and it's been discussed by Santucci and various others. So the connection between water and sovereignty is quite well established. What I want to focus on is precisely how is this connection between water and sovereignty expressed poetically and ritually. So given the intimate connection between water and kingship, richly attested in the Vedic hymns, it would be surprising if water did not play a significant role in the rituals of sovereignty reflected in the Vedic corpus. How does a human being gain control of the fertile powers of the waters which appear to be inseparable from political authority? As a matter of fact, water and its various aliforms constitute the crucial element in the performance of the royal unction rite, the Rajabhisheka, the central feature of the ritual complex of the royal consecration of the Rajasuya. According to the mantras uttered during the course of the rite, it is the waters themselves that engender the king and invest him with sovereignty. For the unction rite, just for some background, for the unction festival, waters from different provinces are brought to the ritual ground, and these include seawater, various types of river and stream water, well water, spring water, water from the stagnant puddles and ponds, as well as other substances that are treated as forms of water, such as honey, milk, curds, and ghee. These are drawn from the separate containers in which they have been gathered, and after a libation that is made with them, the individual waters are poured together into a single vessel. After having been purified, the waters are decanted into the four unction cups, and the residue remaining in the collective vessel is disposed of through an offering into the Agnidriya fire. After a number of intervening preparations, the unction proper is carried out. The sacrificer stands upon a tiger skin pelt with his arms raised above him. Four officiants positioned around the sacrificer at the four cardinal points pour over him the unction fluids from the unction cups. After anointing the sacrificer, they spread the dripping fluid upwards along the sacrificer's body, and the excess unction fluid is collected for use in a subsequent rite. The drenching of the king with the concentrated liquid poured over him on four sides constitutes the culmination of the action. It is not a contradiction to see in this ritual action a means to secure ample rainfall, while at the same time, as some have done, Oberle's, others, while at the same time emphasizing the motifs of conception and birth, and to see the unction rite as producing a new body of the king, which will ritually which will ritually experience the cosmic process of birth, death, and regeneration, and thus promote fertility, which is a rough outline of Heisterman's thesis. And yet integrated within this cosmic drama, by which the king becomes identified with the cosmos in the form of the lord of offspring, of Prajapati, again as Heisterman proposed, it's unmistakable fact that the waters of the unction rite are credited with the pragmatic task of conferring political power upon the king. The formulas that are uttered throughout these proceedings reveal unambiguously that it is the waters themselves that are invested with the power to bestow sovereignty. When Maitrayani Samhita and Katha Samhita describe the waters as king engendering, or Rajasuya, it expresses both the cosmic dimension according to which the individual is reborn through the unction rite as a new being, as well as the more mundane fact that the individual with whom the waters come into contact is vested with sovereign powers. However, other mantras employed in connection with the initial drawing and libation of the unction fluids emphasize the purely political significance of the unction, explicitly calling the waters givers of dominion, Rashtrada, and asking them to give dominion to the sacrificer being consecrated through the rite. Moreover, a number of the fluids are addressed with individual formulas that unmistakably indicate their potency as kingmakers. Thus, one batch is called Vishwabhurt, bearers of all, while another is called Janabhurt, the bearer of the peoples. Similarly, in a triplet recited by the Rigvedic priest at the anointing of the king as prescribed within the Aitareya Brahmana, the waters are bearers and increasers of dominion. The mantra that is employed at the moment when all of the liquids collected from different places are concentrated in a single vessel, so when all the waters which have been are represented as collected from all possible sources in the earth are collected in a single vessel, the mantra that accompanies this makes it clear that it is through the joining together of the previously dispersed liquids that the concoction acquires the potency that will be conveyed to the king as sovereign power. The mantra is, O sweet divine waters mixed together, winning great rule for him who is eligible for rule. Sit unassailable, possessed of power, placing great splendor in him who is eligible for rule. So place kshatra in him who is kshatriya. We may here recognize a typical motif that we first encountered in the course of our review of the political symbolism of fire. Power is an integration in the center of elements scattered throughout the periphery. When the disparate clans, each with their own separate hearth, come together to kindle the common fire belonging to their common leader, it is a way of expressing their political identity and of concentrating their political and their military power. In the present case, when the waters run together in a common vessel, they become charged with power, and it is this power that will confer upon the eligible sacrificer as sovereign rule. Although the motif of integration of dispersed elements is reflected in the preparation of the unction fluid, we have yet to see an explicit connection between the cosmic element of water and the political entities, the clans, in the way that we saw an identification between the dispersed fires and the individual clans. Was the sovereignty conferred by the waters through the unction rite seen to come solely from the elements of the cosmos, without any mythic correspondences on the socio-political level? Quite the contrary. The collection of the various waters in the common vessel directly represented the unification of clan power. The waters are the clans. It is because of this that sovereignty, kshatra, was seen to be contained in the waters. In the Rig Veda, the identification of clans and waters is expressed explicitly through the image of rivers joining to a sea. This is the first example. Just as myriad streams, following their separate courses, unite within the single body of water into which they flow, so do the disparate clans unite under a single leader. The clans, this is Rigveda 8.6.4, the clans, all bounded lands, submit to Indra's fighting spirit, his Manyu, like the rivers to the sea. The simile that associates the clan's unification in a leader with the convergence of separate streams of water in a common receptacle sheds light on the Yajou formula, according to which the waters converging in a common vessel generate sovereignty for the king. The waters represent the clans, and it is the clans that confer sovereignty. The metaphor of the sea ruling over the streams is deployed as one among several apt exemplars in a liturgy manifestly crafted for the proclamation of the sovereignty of an earthly king. The sea rules, this is in Atharvaveda 686.2. The sea rules the streams, fire is the controller of the earth, the moon rules the nakshatras, you be the sole bull. In Atharvaveda 422.1, an individual being proclaimed king is addressed as the sole bull of the clan, Visham Ekavirsha, dispelling any doubt about the implied analogy. Just as the sea is master of the rivers, just as fire, in the form of the sun, is master of earth, and just as the moon is master of the nocturnal, heavenly bodies, so should the earthly king, the bull, be master over the clans and the larger confederations that the clans constitute. The analogy between the king and the sea, based upon the fact that each can be seen as a point of union in which diverse elements flow together, forms the basis for the final verse of an early unction liturgy preserved in the Atharvaveda. Just as the waters flow into the sea, so do the unction fluids flow into the sacrificer over whom they are poured and in the midst of which he stands. The potent waters, reads Atharvaveda 487, the potent waters cleanse the leopard standing in the middle of the waters as if he were the sea. Earlier in this same liturgy, the unction waters had been explicitly identified with the clans. The fourth stanza describes the moment when the sacrificer standing upon the tiger pelt is about to have the unction fluids poured over him. A tiger upon the tiger pelt stride across the great directions, may all clans want you, the divine waters rich in milk. Grammatically, the waters is in opposition to the clans, and this can only mean in this context that the two are directly equated. Politically speaking, it is the clans who approve the leader and who invest in him sovereignty over themselves. On the macrocosmic level, it is the divine waters who will charge the king with power, since the clans only empower a leader whom they choose, at least ideally. Volition is ascribed to as well to the waters who are asked to want him. So there follows, within this hymn, the unction mantra proper, recited when the waters are being poured over the king, leaving us in no doubt that the clan-water connection is specifically a feature of the unction ceremony. The stanza immediately following the anointing then strongly suggests that the unction rite serves in part to generate an alliance between the king and those clans represented by the waters who have chosen him. The heavenly waters rich in milk have just now poured you over with splendor. Savitar will make you such that you will be one whose increase is through alliance. Mitra Vardhana. In this mantra, when the king is referred to as one whose increase is through alliance, which is one interpretation of the compound, what is referred to is his alliances with the clans who, through the unction rite, are proclaiming him king. Taken as a whole, Atharvaveda 4.8 thus demonstrates the consistency of the analogy upon which the symbolism of the unction is based. The unction waters pouring over the king are like the rivers flowing together in the sea, which in turn symbolizes the unification of the clans and the leader proclaimed to the right. The Brahmana texts, too, recognize the aquatic metaphor that underpins the political function of the unction ceremony. In the course of its treatment of the unction rite, the Shatapatha Brahmana makes an explicit analogy between the relationship of the sea to the rivers and the relationship of a king to the clans. Explaining the effect of anointing the sacrificer in the royal unction with the waters from the lord of the rivers, Nadipati, i.e. with seawater, the text states that the act renders him lord of the clans, Vishampati. In other words, by pouring seawater over the sacrificer, one invests in him the unified powers of all the rivers, and this is the macrocosmic corollary to the investment of the unified powers of the clans that serve as the political basis for the king's sovereignty. The motif of the divine waters as political entities was not an ad hoc trope worked up by isolated poets. It constituted a formative element in the ritual symbolism of the rite. As we have seen, water metaphors are used throughout the unction liturgies to express the political power of clans. Within the rituals themselves, water is utilized in various ways to emphasize the dominant theme in the process of political legitimization in the early Vedic period. that of dispersed polities coming together and depositing their own sovereign rights into a central figure, maximizing power by concentrating it all at the center. Water, like fire, is tangible. It can be drawn from far away and brought to hand on the ritual ground, and it is equally subject both to division into many isolated containers as well as to concentration within a single common vessel. The properties of water made it very useful for ritual manipulations designed to express unification and concentration. But what was considered to actually invest the king with powers were not the unction waters themselves, but what they bore within them. As we have seen, this is sometimes explicitly called kshatra, or rashtra, so rule or dominion. Far more regularly, however, the unction liturgies specify this power in the waters by the designation of splendor or varchas. I think I'll stop there, and if you would like me to go into further the relationship between the waters and varchas, splendor, and so forth, I can do so. But I would turn the floor over to questions, if anyone.
Sorry, about questions.
Let me just set the stage for the questions you may have. The texts, which many of you are probably already familiar with, which we're working, are themselves ritual texts, and our reconstruction of Vedic society is also based primarily upon these same ritual texts, which means that one's oftentimes prone to a bit of circular reasoning. So the method of, more broadly, of interpretation that I've applied here is to survey the various reconstructions of the social and political constitution of the early Vedic period and try to see whether or not that is expressed or articulated within the rites themselves. And what I think I can say is that there are good reasons for understanding the poetic and ritual evidence as endorsing the fission-fusion interpretation of a clan-based system, for example, over some of the more, shall we say, territorially based conceptualizations of kingship that one met with usually in the older literature. So that was in a sense, the approach that I'm taking here. The accusation that I've had in the past was that I've assumed as a premise a particular political constitution in the early Vedic period, and then kind of approached the text from that perspective. But in fact, that wasn't really the method behind it. Really what it was to lay out the various reconstructions of the political constitution separately, and then look within the texts at those joints within the ritual texts where aspects of political power are negotiated, and see if maybe one model fits another.
Well, I'll ask you. It's a very interesting paper. A lot of questions, some things I need to think about a little bit more, but maybe you'll start by just asking a really unfair question, and that is, how argumentative, I mean, you just gave us this little explanation of your relationship to the circularity problem of working with just the Rig Veda and the Atharva Veda, and then imagining both the social context and then also sort of particular features against that social context. This business, I mean, how argumentative do you have to be about translation of certain terms like Vish and Mitra and so on? And how, to what extent are you just more or less on safe ground within the field, to the extent that the field is ever in agreement about these sorts of...
No, every single one of the important terms here is up to be contested. So Vish, as translated as clan, for example. What I've done in a more extensive, and Mitra also, obviously, in terms of the alliance, what I've done in a more extensive version of this is to discuss what are the necessary characteristics of a vish in order for my argument to work. Mm-hmm. So what I settle on is, for example, the translation clan, because because a vish, as represented in the earlier texts, and actually, I mean, actually, it is often so even in the Yajurveda texts. It does. There isn't a clear distinction always, particularly in the mantra sections of the Yajurveda texts. The early Vedic vish is a locus for kinship relations, and this is all demonstrable. It is a basic unit that engages in martial activity. It is coterminous with settlement. In other words, it fits the qualifications of what I need for my argument, which is that it possesses fire. So what I would say is that the translation is a bit of an issue because people the anthropologists are quite contentious about what clan denotes precisely as well. The other terminological problem is king. I mean, people have asked exactly what does a rajan refer to in the Rigvedic material as well as later on. Some Scharf, for example, says, well, there are no kings. You know, there are warlords or military leaders that go under that title, whereas others are sort of more along. So yes, to be short, yes, there's not a term that's translated here that's not contentious, and I hope what I've tried to do is establish the minimal number of characteristics necessary for the rest of my argument regarding the ritual and the poetic expression to work.
Yeah. Well, of course, a good explanation is only refuted by a better one. We can think about it that way. So, well, the thing that we don't get a sense of from the paper as you read it is your sense of how total your explanatory coverage is. That is, the number of times that rituals in which sort of there are fires belonging to peoples mm-hmm. arise, how many of them, does this model explain most, or are there problematic sections, or is there a whole sort of as yet anomalous, unexplained corpus of other vish fires that simply don't enter into this model?
A lot of indeterminate material. A lot of indeterminate material, which could be contorted to fit the argument, but could also be explained differently. Mm. I don't think it's necessary to have complete coverage, in a sense. I think that, for example, when I didn't really move very far away from the Vedic material, I discussed a little bit the Rajasuya, but when one approaches the composition of the Shrauta ritual system, particularly with the rites of fire, so the Agnichayana in particular, which really requires a full treatment in and of itself, which is why I didn't go into it at all. But if we allow for the fact that the Shrauta constitution is the product of a lot of reworking, and if we can agree that a lot of what the reworking did, I mean, this would obviously have to be argued for, but I think it is very convincing. A lot of what was done in the reworking was to separate the ritual system from the political system and associations with leaders, and in a sense generalize it to the twice born, more generally, apart from specifically the leadership figures. What we actually see is we can retrieve quite a bit of kshatra-oriented material from these rites. The Agnichayana, the Agnadeya, and so forth. And as a result, I think that this model works quite well even for some of these Shrauta motifs we come up with. And in order to do that, what one really has to do is look less at the sutra, a little bit less at the sutra material and a little bit more at the mantra material, the Yajurveda mantra material, and not presume always that the sutra and even the prose you know, even the Brahmana-style prose materials that are interpreting those rites, don't always assume that they apply the mantras as they were originally intended to be applied. And oftentimes I think that the Yajurveda mantra is much more closely associated, both in sort of language and semantic domain and so forth, with Atharvaveda and Rigveda than with later period. But I mean, obviously, all of that is subject to a much more in detail, much more in depth discussion.
Well, I'll ask one more, which is just what's again another unfair question, but it seems implied here. What's your picture of the Rigveda? I mean, we've got a period which is sort of early Vedic. And then within that period, you can draw from a variety of texts to construct this argument. But the Atharvaveda, at least for the water side of it, is your liturgical text, and the Rig Veda seems to be the poetics text. I'm not sure it divides quite so neatly, maybe. But for the fire one, a lot of the appeals to ritual seem to come out of Rig Veda passages. So what is that Rig Veda text that we have preserved if it's not a... It's not a ritual manual as such, is it? So, you know, why do we preserve the hymn for a particular king whose name is named there? Why is that preserved as a ritual? If that's a purpose built, you know, sukta that was created for a particular ritual in a certain moment.
I mean, that's the enduring question. I think.
See, I told you it was unfair.
No, but I'll give you in a nutshell, because this is sort of my this is my take on all of that, very as briefly as I possibly can give it to you, which is that the basic social unit responsible for the production and then the preservation of liturgical poetry in the early Vedic period, in the Rig Vedic period, was because people use it, let's say family. The family book, those groups that are associated with books 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, lineage units, produced the poetry. Now, they also preserved it within their circles. Why did they preserve it? Did they preserve it because they needed a ritual manual? The Rig Veda, there's nothing to indicate that the Rig Veda is organized as a ritual manual, or even that the texts preserved are comprehensive as a ritual. They do seem, however, to represent sort of the highlights of the Soma rite. So I do think that in general, what has been preserved is in the family books, the 2 through 7 of the Rig Veda is material for the Soma rite. It wasn't necessarily preserved for performance. It may have very well been preserved for as examples of particularly nice liturgical pieces. Now, why do we say it wasn't preserved for performance? Because within the context of the hymns themselves, it's very clear that what they treasured was the new hymn. Now, it was a new hymn built on older paradigms, older models, and they're constantly saying that this hymn, this sukta which I'm making now, this new sukta, which is in the fashion of the father, the ancestors, or you know, Atrivat, or wherever, however it may be, it's in the fashion of the earlier composers within the tradition. A premium was placed on the new twist. So I would argue that the practice that we meet with in the classic, in the Shrauta rites, of sort of the ossification of the liturgical corpus and the rote memorization of that corpus, not only for the sake of sort of internalizing your poetic technique, but also for performance itself, was actually what defined the creation of the Shrauta system and what distinguishes it fundamentally from Rig Vedic practice. Mm-hmm. No longer do we have the creative contribution of the poet at the moment of performance, not that he didn't ruminate upon it beforehand, but as he stood on the ritual ground, making, you know, with the performance underway, an analysis of the hymns really does make clear that they were recited within this ritual context, in my opinion. What happened then that led to the practice of rote memorization? Big story, but we can say for sure that already in the Rig Vedic text itself, we have examples of that happening. In the ninth book of the Rig Veda, there's a soma, a collection of soma hymns, which very nicely, not only does it incorporate all of the principal rishis that are the principal rishis in the Gotra system later on, so in other words, it's seeking to represent as ecumenical a picture as possible about, you know, within one liturgy. But at the end of that liturgy, it has verses which say, I memorize, I study these verses because they represent the rasa of that's been brought together, samvarta, that's been brought together from all of these other sources. So what I would argue would be that somewhere along the line, under some impetus or another, somebody decided that it would be better to channel all the energies of all these disparate groups who produced and preserved this poetry and canonize it. Once that canonization occurred, that canon became the source of all liturgical poetry, to the point where really, if you go through the Vedic liturgies, most of the material that's in verse form, it almost all comes from Rig Veda, and where it doesn't, like in certain passages, you know, the Ayurvedic verses and the Agni China rites and so on, it's demonstrably developed sort of a bit later, you know, linguistically and so forth. So yes, I mean basically the Rig Veda in terms of why did they compose it, it's quite clear that some of the techniques that were used to preserve it, for example, show up in the Avesta as well. So certain types of, like for example, Napadapada readings, that method is, as I understand it, reflected as well in the Iranian preservation of materials as well. So preservation of liturgical materials must have been very old. Anyway, it's a long story.
Yeah, that's good.
I think we should carry on for another 10 minutes if we may.
I have a quick question. I also enjoyed your talk very much. You mentioned that the Agni Chayana and the Agni Anheya might have stuff that you could tease out and for the earlier period. Have you thought about the Sutra stuff as well? Because that would be very rich, I think, in pictures of a political and economic society. Sacrifices come together independently, functioning as priests, all for the use of the same implements.
Yeah.
What you do if one of them dies, you have to bring in someone else from the clan, which is pretty. Later stuff, but
No, you're absolutely right, and of course, a lot of the, like Falk, for example, has made much of the Sutra as representative of a much older situation within the rite. So no, you're absolutely right. What I tried to do is really focus a little bit on the continuity of structures. What I didn't get into here is, for example, I would even make the argument, for example, that this business of liturgy represents the same general idea, which is that there is a tendency to view a relationship of center and periphery, and that the mediation between these two, the regulation of the relationship between the two, is reflected in a great many areas, ritual areas. So we see the fire. We see the water. Within the water, there's this element that I refer to as varchas, which is this splendor. Splendor, actually, what is splendor? Splendor is quite clearly, within this context, the splendor of both the fire and the sun. The splendor is passed into the king, who is closely connected with both fire and sun. And in a sense, he's born through the amalgamation of the splendor, which is merely a metaphorical way of expressing Kshatra and Rashtra, as far as I interpret it. What I tried to do was focus on those elements within the ritual system that had poetic reflections, so that I could argue not only from the area of ritual action, but also from the poetic reflections, because then I felt that there were two two sources of evidence which were reinforcing. Now, the sutra material, although it's very interesting, it hasn't as I've seen it, as I've looked at it yet, it hasn't fit as neatly into sort of my method as some of the other ones. But you're absolutely right that I have no doubt that it is a rich source. Yeah.
Could I ask you to elaborate a bit more on how you see the Atharva Veda having, you know, following up on Chris's question, you know, about the Rig Veda, and I realise also, you know, very very nasty question, but I mean specifically how you see the material that you've used about the king and the Abhishekha and the Atharva Veda against the general character of limited, Veda as a whole.
Yeah, limited.
Why is it there?
Limited to that. Well, oh, I see. Well, the interesting thing is that the actual, a lot of the Yangshun material, and please, anybody who does need to go, feel free, don't feel like you need to, and that includes,
don't want to hear the answer to this one.
I thought we pointed out 5 minutes.
the thing about I have no view, really, to tell you the truth, on the Atharva Veda as a whole. My good friend Arlo, I'll leave to solve that. But I did need to come to terms with the place, you know, the place of these particular king related materials within the Atharva Veda. Now, one of the things that's interesting is that much of the material that I used, that I refer to as the Atharva Veda, is actually more properly could also be cross referenced to collections primarily in Katha, but also in Taittiriya Brahmana. Katha Samhita and Taittiriya Brahmana, the Sava, what would be known as the Sava rites, that were discussed. Honda has a bit of a discussion about them. Anyway, what they are is those rites in which an unction text is performed of various varieties. Now, what you find is whole hymns that I've referred to, but also individual verses, stanzas from those hymns show up not just in the Atharva Veda, both Shanaka and Padmalata, but also in this material in the Yajurveda. So this gives us a nice check on how it was understood by the tradition. Not only do we have the connection with the unction that's clear from the verses themselves, we don't need to rely on the Kaushika, which is, after all, nobody knows always how primary that relationship between the mantra and the Kaushika Sutra is. Or the Avatana Sutra as well. It's very unclear how primary that relationship is. But we can also look to the sutras that prescribe the material in the Black Yajurveda tradition and see that they understood these as connected to unctions, that very often they understood them specifically as royal unctions. Given all that, the way I understand this material are liturgies which were used in a rite with which the Rig Veda was not necessarily concerned. Perhaps later, maybe later, slightly later in composition, maybe, but still well within the early Vedic tradition. So they're perfectly sort of apt material for early Vedic reconstruction. Now, what it tells us about why that material was preserved in the Atharva Veda, I have no view on.
Yeah. I have a question which require a yes or a no answer, but if I'm having...
I don't give those. I don't know that.
You've shown how the fire becomes the uniting symbol of the vish, as it were, of the community. And there's a French thinker called René Girard. He's not an Indologist, but he draws on Sylvia Levy, and he argues that the sacrifice and the fire becomes a symbol of unity because the violence of a community becomes